It's Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, Wisconsin has the highest rate of drunk driving per capita in the country, but few new regulations to stem the problem passed in the last legislative session.
First, on Friday, Wisconsin's Transportation Secretary Mark Gottlieb proposed new rate hikes to raise more than $750 million for road infrastructure projects. This is after Governor Walker and Republican lawmakers said the state needs to find additional revenue to pay for road repairs and new roads, but would like to do so without raising taxes.
The DOT recommendation, which comes just a week and a half after the midterm elections, would raise the gas tax, impose fees on the purchase of new vehicles, and increase vehicle registration fees for hybrid and electric vehicles.
Patrick Marley has details on the proposed rate hikes and what it means for drivers. He's a State House reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
So Transportation Secretary Mark Gottlieb proposed that the state will need $750 million for the state's roads. What will the money pay for exactly?
Well, first of all, that's just one piece of many elements to the budget. The state's roads cost more than $1 billion a year, more like $1.5 billion a year, and that is to pay for, expansions, maintenance, tearing up everything, from the smallest pothole to the largest projects in the state, like the zoo interchange. They give money to local governments to pay for their local roads, bike paths. That also includes airports and harbors, things like that.
And so he is putting forth this proposal, hoping that in some way we can raise the money to facilitate those improvements. How exactly is he hoping to get through with that?
Okay, and also the $750 million he's seeking, he's also seeking other money in addition to that from, like, the main account that the state has that pays for schools and healthcare programs. He wants $500 million of that money, and he wants to borrow $800-some million to help pay for projects. So there's a lot of funding sources, but what drew the headlines on Friday was a $750 million. That would be a 5-cent increase in the gas tax that we pay. Right now it's about 33 cents a gallon that you pay for a tank of gas, for a gallon of gas. That would raise to 37 cents, and it would have the ability to increase in future years automatically. There would also be a new fee that's paid on any new vehicle that is purchased. So the example he gave is a $32,000 car would have an $800 fee put on top of it. That would not be applied to used vehicles. And then, as you mentioned in the intro, there would be an additional registration fee that people who have hybrid or electric cars would have to pay.
Talk a little bit about that. It sounds as though that would be a $50 increase per year on electric cars and hybrids.
That's right. The annual fee right now for all cars and light trucks is $75 that everybody pays each year, and hybrid and electric vehicles would pay that $75 and then an additional $50. The rationale there is that the state's roads are paid for primarily with the gas tax and with the vehicle registration fees. People who drive hybrid cars use less gas, and therefore they pay lower fees in the gas tax. And so they're trying to increase the amount of money those drivers pay with their registration fees.
Mm-hmm. And there's also a special price for being placed on diesel fuel as opposed to gasoline. Can you talk about that?
Yes. So the gas tax increase would be considerably bigger, about 10 cents a gallon compared to 5 cents a gallon for diesel. And that's because, semis use diesel, and they do put the most wear on our roads. And so the idea is that they should pay a greater share because they do more damage. Now, there are some passenger vehicles that use diesel as well. Those people would get a break on the registration fee they pay of $25 a year. So instead of paying the $75 annual registration fee, they would pay $25 less, or $50, because they would be paying more in fuel taxes when they go fill up.
Now, it might be too soon to speculate if this proposal were to pass, how it would affect consumer behavior. For example, whether someone might be dissuaded from buying a hybrid vehicle. What other implications might come about as a result of a proposal like this?
Sure. So we are a long way from this being adopted. You know, this is just a request from Governor Walker's transportation secretary to the governor. He has to formally say he's going to do that or not do it or modify it in some way and then present it to the legislature. And they have to, you know, they could change it in any way. They could reject it. They could make modifications to it. They could double the fines. They could cut them in half, whatever they wanted to do. But as proposed, I think the biggest effects would be on the new vehicle fee. That would be a disincentive to buy a new vehicle because you could buy a car that's a year or two old and pay a lower price just because that's the price of a used vehicle, and also not get hit with this additional fee. You're right, somebody who was looking at buying a hybrid vehicle would have to think about the cost of buying that car, which is typically more than a similar size sedan. Knowing that they would be paying an additional fee every year during the time that they owned that.
Mm-hmm. Now, just about 2 weeks ago, voters approved an amendment to the state constitution with regards to protecting the state transportation fund. I'm curious about the timing of this announcement. Is it purely coincidental? Is it something that was on the state's agenda no matter what? Or would we still be talking about this today if voters had not approved that transportation amendment?
I think that we would have been talking about this regardless, but the proponents of those who want to see these more money go to transportation have said that they saw the amendment, which passed by 75% or 80%, as crucial because in past years there had been some transfers out of the transportation fund to pay for schools, and they said that they believed that the public was uncertain about paying a higher gas tax because they wouldn't be confident that money would really go toward roads. And so they wanted that amendment in place so that people knew every penny they put in the gas tax would actually go toward the roads, which is now going to be the case because of this amendment that was adopted. It should be noted, though, that although a number of years ago there was more than $1 billion taken out of the transportation to pay for schools and other general programs. All of that money has been, in one form or another, put back into the transportation fund and then some. So there was a lot of borrowing done to backfill that transfer. And there were also just straight out reverse transfers from the general fund into the transportation budget. So if you look back over 10 years, the transportation fund has actually gained about $300 from the general fund rather than losing any money to it.
Mm-hmm. And how will this proposal affect measures to reduce dependence on fossil fuels?
That's a good question. I don't know that it would. The state is trying to broaden the way that it gets money for transportation because cars are becoming more fuel efficient, and so they're paying less in fuel taxes. And as they do that, it's good for consumers because they can drive further on a tank of gas, but it's bad for the state's transportation fund because less money is coming into it. So that fund has really been pretty stagnant for the last decade, either going up a small amount or going down a small amount year to year. So this would still rely heavily on the gas tax because that would be the primary source of funding it. But they're trying to, with these new fees on vehicles, find ways to get other sources of revenue into the transportation fund.
Patrick Marley, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
That was Patrick Marley, State House reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Wisconsin has the most drunk drivers per capita of any state in the entire country. It's the only state in the entire country that treats first-time drunken driving offenses not as a crime, but as a traffic violation.
Despite Wisconsin's drunk driving record, virtually all legislation that attempted to address the problem during the 2013-14 legislative session failed. Even laws that were authored by leading Republicans in a Republican-held legislature did not pass.
The Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism looked into what exactly happened to these bills, and Bill Leaders is with us. He's the money and politics editor at the Center for Investigative Journalism. Bill, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here.
So take us back to the last session. What kind of drunk driving prevention measures were introduced in the legislature?
Well, there were a raft of proposals that were introduced, and all more than a dozen bills were introduced in the last session that would toughen the penalties on people who drink and drive. Some of them called for mandatory minimum sentences for people who injure or kill others. Some of them would have increased penalties for repeat offenders. One of the bills that was introduced by Republicans would have made first offense drunk driving a crime if the blood alcohol content or concentration of the person was more than 0.15, which is about twice the legal limit. There's a Democratic bill introduced later on which would have made first offense drunk driving in Wisconsin a crime, as it is in every other state, regardless of what the blood alcohol content of the person was. Both of those failed. There's even a measure that was introduced which would require all persons who are charged with drunken driving, whether it's a crime or whether it's a ordinance violation of forfeiture, to appear in court. Presently, it is still possible to for some people to not even make a court appearance when they've been charged with driving under the influence. And this would have required that everyone who's charged show up. That passed one of the houses of the legislature on a vote overwhelmingly, passed the other house on a voice vote, and it went nowhere. In fact, all of the bills that were introduced by Republicans early in the session and just about all the bills that were introduced later in the session failed. They either passed one of the houses, the assembly, and didn't pass the Senate, or they didn't go anywhere at all.
So you've outlined several things that happen, and in many cases, it sounds like there's bipartisan support. So why is it failing?
Well, ultimately, it was up to the Senate Majority Leader to schedule votes on these bills, and that person is Senator Scott Fitzgerald, who did provide a substantive reply to my inquiries. And he outlined what I think is really the crux of the matter for some Republicans, is they do not feel that making the laws tougher is necessarily the right approach, that what they think needs to be done to deal with this problem of chronic offenders, it has to do with providing more in the way of treatment, to funnel more money to the drug and alcohol treatment courts, which have been set up. And Republicans have embraced this. They directed more $3 million of additional funding to drug courts in the last legislative session for a two-year period, and they're big supporters of this. And there's blowback against increasing penalties because of the cost that it entails, you know, additional cost of incarcerating people, additional court cost of processing people. Some of the estimates which came out in the course of the legislation have been decried as overblown, people talking about hundreds of millions of dollars that of additional expenses the state would incur. And supporters of the bills, including the person I spoke to, is Representative Jim Ott, a Republican lawmaker who, together with Senator Alberta Darling, introduced the initial package of six bills. He felt that those cost estimates were just overblown, that they didn't take into account what he expected would occur, is that toughening the laws would have a deterrent effect, and there would be fewer people who would be prosecuted, that there would be fewer people who would be incarcerated, and so you couldn't just say that increasing the penalties is going to result in this much additional cost.
So to what extent is simply having a public debate over the matter increasing the awareness and possibly decreasing the level of instance of drunk driving? Is that enough, or what's it going to take to get some laws passed in the state house?
Well, it depends who you ask. Is it enough? The number of people who are arrested in the state of Wisconsin for driving while intoxicated has been going down. The number of people who die in alcohol-related fatalities has been going down for a period of years. Several years ago, the average was more than 300 people a year who would die in alcohol-related crashes. Now it's averaging closer to about 200. The last count was 185, I believe that was in 2013. And so people who are advocating approaches other than making the laws tougher will point to it and say, look, we've achieved some reductions already, in part because we have made our laws tougher, and in part because we've embraced these other approaches. But you can look at it the other way. And as the person I spoke to from Mothers Against Driving said, we still have 200 people a year who are dying in events that are 100% preventable. And it's unacceptable for us to tolerate that level of carnage.
So under the current law, what penalties do exist for drunk driving?
It depends on the offense, whether it's, you know, your third offense or fourth offense. In the state of Wisconsin, you can actually have a fourth offense drunk driving that is not counted as a felony if your fourth offense happens more than 5 years after your third offense. One of the bills that was introduced would have erased that type of a loophole and said if you get arrested three times for drunken driving, it's a felony. That means you can potentially face up to a year of incarceration. For some of the higher offenses, it can be much higher. One of the findings of Gannett Wisconsin Media, which ran my story and which ran a very enterprising series of stories, which you can find online at any of the Gannett newspapers. One of the findings is that many judges were not sentencing people to the minimums that were prescribed by the law. They weren't even following the law when it came to sentencing people to minimum amounts of sentences.
And you had said earlier that it's possible that under certain circumstances that you don't have to appear in court after a drunk driving stop. I hope I'm summarizing that accurately.
Yeah, it's if your first offense, and I believe if you don't need an occupational license and you don't need some sort of dispensation and you just want to pay your fine and get on with your life, I think you can send in the payment and not even have a court appearance. Now, a state senator I spoke to, Tim Carpenter, who backed the package of bills that the Republicans introduced, in some cases he was the only Democrat who did so, I mean, he told me a very compelling story about his own father, who was an alcoholic and who was arrested in 1996 for driving under the influence and who did have to go to court. And it was a shattering experience for him, someone who respected authority, to have to stand before a judge and accept the humiliation of what he had done. And it prompted a change in his life. And he stopped drinking and he was sober for the last 13 years of his life. And so Tim Carpenter had seen with his own eyes and through his own experience how a mandatory court appearance could make a world of difference. Why something like that did not pass the legislature is a mystery to him.
And, you know, if you ask any, I don't know, some people on the street, they might say, well, wait a minute, as I watch the legislature debate this topic and agree that something needs to be done, but disagree over how it's going to be done. Some might wonder what role lobbyists play in the discussion. Have you looked into that, and what did you find?
I did a little. The Tavern League of Wisconsin and Miller Coors are the big lobby groups, the ones who have registered and who have spent the most time and hence the most money on these issues. Neither of these groups opposed the majority of the bills that were introduced. In fact, the Tavern League has in the past supported legislation to toughen penalties for drunken driving. The only bill that the Tavern League opposed in this session was a bill that would make make it mandatory for anybody convicted of drunken driving in Wisconsin to have an interlock ignition device installed in his or her vehicle. That is MAD, Mothers Against Driving. That's the number one legislative priority of that organization in Wisconsin and nationally, is to promote these laws, which it feels has made a substantial difference in terms of reducing drunk driving fatalities in the 24 states where it is either mandatory or strongly incentivized. But the Tavern League did oppose that. The bill did go nowhere, and it will remain the top legislative priority of some of the anti-drunk driving forces.
And this is certainly a multifaceted issue. One underlying factor is quite possibly the drinking culture in Wisconsin. Has the state legislature considered other means of addressing the cultural aspect of what's behind the issue of drunk driving?
Not that I know of. And I think that's something that not just the legislature, but the entire society needs to be part of. Clearly, there is a culture in Wisconsin which tolerates drinking and which tolerates drinking and driving. Now, I suspect that that is being eroded, as it should be, but it's still tolerated to a frankly obnoxious extent in this state. And it does need to be the source of not just legislation, but also a more generalized focusing of resources and an insistence on people. I'm going to say something I hate when people say that it's not okay. It is not okay for us to continue to tolerate anybody putting others at risk because they insist on drinking and driving.
Mm-hmm. In our last minute here, what might we expect? Might we expect a different outcome in the next session?
It's hard to say. I think that what Senator Fitzgerald told me is that they are interested in monitoring the success or lack of the drug treatment courts, which they have, you know, funneled more money toward. There will be some of these proposals will be introduced again. They will be debated again. I don't know whether they'll stand a greater chance. We have both a governor and an attorney general who are not keen on the idea of making first offense drunk driving a crime in Wisconsin. So I'm not sure whether that it's likely that that will pass. But all of these issues will return because the drunk drivers have not gotten off of our roads.
Bill, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Bill Leaders, a reporter and Money and Politics Project Director for the Center, Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, which collaborates with Wisconsin Public Radio. His report last week examined why no new drunk driving legislation has passed the State House despite support for it.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Recent events in Ferguson, Missouri, and across the nation have put a watchful eye on police and police tactics.
And beyond that, there is growing conversation over strained relationships between law enforcement officials and minority communities. A new effort is aiming to overcome that and to diffuse tensions that could lead to conflicts like those currently playing out in Ferguson.
Earlier this fall, the U.S. Justice Department announced a major grant launching the National Initiative for Building Community Trust and Justice. The stated goal is to combat distrust and hostility between law enforcement and the communities they serve.
David Kennedy joins us now. He is the director of the National Network for Safe Communities at the Center for Crime Prevention and Control at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, and he is the director of the new initiative. David, welcome to the program.
Hi, Gene. Nice to be back with you.
I want to start out with a little bit of background on what led to this, because a lot of people are automatically going to be listening to the news today. They're going to be hearing about Ferguson, and they're going to be connecting that with this. And certainly there's a relationship there. But this initiative we're talking about today has been a long time coming.
It's been a very long time coming. Yeah, that's right.
So tell me a bit about it. There's $4.75 million, as I understand it. The Department of Justice is distributing this money. And now what?
So let's turn the clock back just a little bit. And the moment that Ferguson has created is important. It's scary. It's tragic, of course. And the only good thing about it is that it has focused the nation's attention on this issue, and a lot of us think has thereby created a real opportunity. And this particular opportunity that's been created actually has quite a long gestation period. In the immediate framework of the actions by the Department of Justice, this goes back at least into the period more than a year ago, after the president made his speech after the Trayvon Martin verdict. And the president, in a very, very careful but clearly very heartfelt speech, said, in essence, the kind of thing that we have just seen happens far too often. It causes enormous harm, and this administration wants to do something about it. And in the wake of that, the Justice Department put together a very, very careful, open process in which it identified what it viewed as three themes that hold real promise for making real progress on this issue. Those three themes have been in development in scholarship and in practice on the ground for decades now. So the real gestation period here is generational. And I'll sketch those three really quickly and then talk about, again, very briefly, why we think this is so important. So It is now no secret, and Ferguson has highlighted the fact that all over the country there are broken and, I'm happy to say, toxic relationships between law enforcement, especially the police, and very angry, disenfranchised, alienated communities, especially black communities. And the Justice Department said, we see the following three things holding enormous promise for actually making headway on the ground. And those three things are what scholarship calls procedural justice. And that is a very large body of work that says even if you treat citizens legally, but they feel disrespected, abused, they do not feel that they have had a chance to be heard, they don't think you're doing what you're doing in their own best interest, they don't think they're being treated fairly, it may be legal, but it will be experienced as ugly and oppressive, and that the process, therefore procedural justice, is as important and even more important than either the legality or the outcome. And in my home city of New York, that's sort of the last couple of years of policing distilled down to its essence, in which certain parties in the city said very high numbers of stop and frisk are legal and effective, and the city voted literally to say, regardless, we do not wish to be treated like this. So justice said, let us figure out how to enhance on the ground in practice procedural justice. Second vector here was what scholars call implicit bias, and that is the fact, and it is a fact, that we can have very bad behavior by individuals and institutions that has, for example, outcomes of grievous racial disparity, is experienced by communities and citizens as racist, looks like institutional and personal racism, and is in fact driven not by racism, but by kind of learned shortcut psychology. So to take a concrete example, folks in law enforcement who are fed a steady diet, because this is the way their work directs them, of young black male offenders will develop habits of mind in which they think of young black men as criminals, even though most of the young black men in the communities they police are not criminals. And their mental reflex will then lead often to racial disproportionality, even though as individuals they are not racist. And that is behavior that can be assessed and corrected. And then the third one is the piece that I've been most heavily involved in, which is that in communities that have long and bad histories with the police, and we don't like to face this, but that is the reality of the law's relationship historically with African-American communities in this country. And when your collective memory of that begins with slavery and slave catching and the abuses during Reconstruction after the Civil War and the black codes and Jim Crow and separate but equal, I work with black adults who were present when their grandparents were lynched. This is live memory for them. That we do not make progress on these issues until both sides acknowledge that history and figure out ways in which, not that they can leave it behind, because you can never leave your history behind, but that you can agree on some common ground and figure out how you can move forward together. And that is what justice is calling reconciliation work.
Now, those are three huge topics. I mean, any one of those, it seems to me, could be, you know, the basis for a project like the one you're talking about. Where do you start when you're dealing with these really huge things and you're dealing with a very specific set of circumstances in, say, a specific town?
So the good news here, and if you look at Ferguson and many other incidents like this, and if you look at the awful, confused, angry aftermath of tragic incidents, one would think that we have no idea how to work in these areas, and the fact is that's not true at all. So I said I would speak to why we are so encouraged by this and why we think it is such an important moment and why the step justice has taken is so strategic. And if you are hip deep in this and you have no life, like those of us who work on these issues are and don't, you know some very encouraging things. So you know, for example, that the better minds in law enforcement are very open to these ideas. If you go to good police executives and say you are trapped in a bad historical relationship with angry communities, your people and your institutions are being driven by implicit bias. We are treating in our contact with the general public every day, especially in these neighborhoods, we are treating citizens so they don't feel like citizens and they are alienated. The good minds in law enforcement today say, yes, that's right. We know that's true, and we are eager to try to do better. Outside the profession, people don't think this. People think law enforcement are Neanderthals, and actually they're far more progressive than not only than people would be inclined to believe, but than in most other lines of work. And we actually know in a very concrete way how to do this work in particular places. So I've been part of a team that's underwritten a procedural justice in-service training that Superintendent Gary McCarthy in Chicago is putting essentially all of his serving officers through. And they are taught the following sorts of things. So there's a real moment from this training, which is electrifying. The training officers, who are seasoned CPD officers, will say to the rank and file, "The community hates us. We don't get that. We come on the job to serve. We will give our lives to protect them. We don't understand why they're so angry at us. So let me, the Chicago training officer, ask you the following question. Think back to the last homicide that you attended, and CPD is on our side of the yellow tape, and the community is on the other side, and the community is heartbroken, and the homicide victims, wife and kids and mother and family and friends and the community is out there, and they already hate us. They already think we're racist. They look at us across the yellow crime scene tape, and what do they see us doing?" And every single serving police officer I have ever told this story to looks at you and says, "Oh my God, they see us laughing," because that's what homicide teams do at homicide scenes. Just like surgeons and EMTs and trauma nurses save their psyches through black humor, cops do the same thing. And they do not understand that in the eyes of a community that already thinks that they are the enemy, that they see then the police laughing over their dead loved ones. And among other things, the corollary here, the implication is very clear: don't laugh. And people walk out of that room understanding how to handle themselves differently. And the same is true for implicit bias. We have real on-the-ground examples of successful reconciliation engagements. This is work in progress that now is going to be elevated and magnified, and we have very, very high hopes for it.
All right, we're going to take a break for a moment. We're talking to David Kennedy of the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, the director of a new initiative we're talking about aimed at building trust between police departments and minority communities.
We continue our conversation with criminal justice expert David Kennedy. He's the director of the National Initiative for Building Community Trust and Justice, an effort to ease tensions between police departments and minority members in communities around the country.
You can join in the discussion at 800-642-1234. What do you think would help reduce this type of conflict around the country? What would you like to see from police departments and from the people they police? Are you in law enforcement? What has your experience been? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can email us, talk at WPR.org. www.thedepartmentofjustice.org. David Kennelly, we're going to be getting to phone calls in just about a minute or so. But before we do that, we've been talking a lot about this from sort of the police side of the equation here. How do you set up communities to be receptive to this project as well? There's going to be, I mean, as you say, there's a lot of history here.
There is, and just as for some reason there is a startling willingness to admit error and move forward on the part of law enforcement, there is, to me, an even more striking willingness to come to partnership and try to figure out how to do better on the part of communities. You know, if there's one thing that I hear more than anything else as I go around the country and I spend kind of equal time on both sides of this divide, both with law enforcement and in these neighborhoods, the first thing these days is we could be Ferguson this afternoon or tomorrow. Everybody knows that this could happen anywhere, and they're petrified by it. And the second is, we're so tired of being tired. The exhaustion and the frustration that has come from living with these broken relationships and the crime problems that come with them and high levels of aggressive policing and what we're now calling mass incarceration and all the men in the neighborhood getting arrested and going to jail, everybody's sick of it. And they're tired of the old conversations that haven't gotten us anywhere. And there is a remarkable willingness among, I find, most of the people on both sides to look for a new way out of this.
And that willingness to have these discussions being funded in part by this project. And $4.75 million on the one hand sounds like a lot of money. On the other hand, as you describe the problem, as you describe the people involved, as you sort of describe everything, it starts to get a lot smaller awfully fast.
It does, but the basic format here makes a lot of sense. So there are three basic elements that nearly $5 million will pay for. One is advancing the state of the art in practice in five sites around the country. So those sites have not been named. They will be selected in the next coming months between our outside academic team and the Department of Justice principals. But there, as I said before the break, there is a lot that we've already learned about how to move in these three thematic areas. We have some notions about how to develop some next steps and new innovations in those areas. And so step one in this will be to throw everything we know how to do and then some things we're going to invent at these issues in places where the jurisdictions and the communities are demonstrably ready and willing to do this and to see how far we can get. And something's going to happen. We're pretty confident about that. Second is a very carefully structured research and evaluation agenda that will document and assess what has happened and what it means in those areas. And then the third is a public communication, public conversation vector, which is going to work to, we hope, inform and even beyond that, we hope, elevate the public conversation around this. Because as much as we know about the way these three core elements work, you know, they're not really part of the everyday discourse on this. And they ought to be, and we're going to try to be a whole lot clearer and more transparent about how this thinking goes.
Now, you mentioned that you're going to be taking a look at five sites or picking out five sites around the country. And you said there, you know, there are going to be sites where folks on both sides are sort of ready for this conversation. How do you have that information already? I mean, is this research that's already been carried out and you've just got a sense for it, or they've told you, or what?
So the principal partners on this are the United States Department of Justice, My group out of John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City, a group called the Center for Policing Equity, which is the nation's, arguably the world's leading experts on this issue of implicit bias and what to do about it. A group out of Yale Law School who are in the same position with respect to procedural justice, and then some very gifted research and implementation people out of the Urban Institute in Washington, D.C. And between those four parties, there are an awful lot of relationships. There's an awful lot of real-world insight into what's going on around the country in different places, who's involved, you know, who's got the highest energy, where things are really ripe for this. And then in addition to that, if you go to the DOJ website on this, anybody who is interested can say, we want to be part of this, please consider us. And we've got a process that's underway right now that will reach back out to people like that, sort of hear from them, listen to them, ask some basic questions, and we'll go forward.
All right. And so we've only got about 15 seconds, but despite all, it sounds daunting, but it sounds like you're optimistic.
I've been working in this area for 30 years. And like everybody else who's committed to doing something about this national tragedy, which is what I think it is, none of us were ever going to give up. But honestly, this is the first time in those 30 years that I have felt optimistic. It's a really good moment.
Well, David, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was David Kennedy. He is the director of the National Network for Safe Communities at the Center for Crime Prevention and Control at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. I'm Gene Purcell, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.